Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today's date is the 8th of October, 2018. It's a Monday, about a minute, 2 minutes or so after 8 a.m. Arizona time. We're going to continue our lesson on the War of the Fleet. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today, and thanks for Liberty Tree Radio for giving us this opportunity, the soapbox, to address some of these issues, have some border news, and some other items. We're sending this broadcast out for Lily Grace Antoinette. My email address is altabib762@hotmail.com, and that's Alpha Lima Tango Hotel Alpha Bravo Echo Bravo 762@hotmail.com. Also, a way to listen, obviously you have to be listening to hear me say how to listen, but you can go to libertytreeradio.4mg.com, or you can call in the telephone number. You can listen on your telephone, 712-432-0900. That's 712-432-0900. A mechanical voice will come on, and you don't have to listen to the whole message. You can punch in 957-464 and then the pound sign at 957-464 and the pound sign. As snow in summer and as rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool. As the bird by wandering, as the swallow by flying, so the curse causeless shall not come. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod for the fool's back. Answer not a fool according to his folly, lest thou also be like unto him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own conceit. He that sendeth a message by the hand of a fool cutteth off the feet and drinketh damage. The legs of the lame are not equal, so is a parable in the mouth of fools. As he that bindeth a stone in a sling, so is he that giveth honor to a fool. As the thorn goeth into the hand of a drunkard, so is a parable in the mouth of fools. The great God that formed all things both rewardeth the fool and rewardeth transgressors. As a dog returneth to his vomit, so a fool returneth to his folly. Seemst thou a man wise in his own conceit? There is more hope of a fool than of him. The slothful man saith, there is a lion in the way, a lion is in the streets. As the door turneth upon his hinges, so doth the slothful upon his bed. The slothful hideth his hand in his bosom. It grieveth him to bring it again to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife belonging not to him is like one that taketh a dog by the ears, as a madman who casteth firebrands, arrows, and death. So is the man that deceiveth his neighbor and saith, am not I in sport? Where no wood is, there the fire goeth out. So where there is no talebearer, the strife ceaseth. As coals are to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. The words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down into the innermost part of the belly. Burning lips and a wicked heart are like a potsherd covered with silver dross. He that hateth dissembleth with his lips and layeth up deceit within him. When he speaketh fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart, whose hatred is covered by deceit. His wickedness shall be showed before the whole congregation. Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him. A lying tongue hateth those that are afflicted by it, and a flattering mouth worketh ruin. Proverbs 26. The little item in the news. Army Special Forces medic will receive the Medal of Honor for Afghan heroism. Scherer, a senior medical sergeant with Special Forces Operational Detachment Alpha 3336 with Special Operations Task Force 33, had been deployed to Afghanistan's Shulk Valley in Nuristan province. According to an Army release, his task as a medic was to support operators who were hunting high-value targets of the Hezbollah Islam Gulbuddin, a militia group with ties to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The militants... The militants had a foothold in the Shulk Valley.
Hello? I know you're already going into your program. I'm going to apologize. I was playing the music. I had everything hooked up before you were in the conference line. Something happened between the time I started the music and everything got rolling, so nobody on air has heard what you're talking about so far, so you may want to start over at this point where we just you heard the music come in when I reconnected.
Okay.
I apologize for the problem. I've been having issues all weekend long with everything.
Okay. Very good. I'll just rewind the tape. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mike down here in Arizona land. Your mind is your primary weapon. Today is the 8th of October, 2018. It's a Monday. You're tuned in to Liberty Tree Radio. Well, be getting back to our lesson on the war of the and we should be able to wrap that up within the next couple of weeks. Thanks for taking the time to tune in today, and thanks for telling your friends about Liberty Tree Radio, and thank you to Liberty Tree Radio for helping us get this message out. Have some border news. Also, we send this broadcast out to Lily Grace Antoinette. Now, my email address is altabib762@hotmail.com. Let's see. The telephone line, the conference line, is 712-432-0900, 712-432-0900. And once you're there, a voice will come on and say that you've reached the conference line and enter in the room number. You don't necessarily have to listen to the whole message, but when the recording starts telling you how to, then you can enter in 957-464 and then the pound sign, 957-464 and then the pound sign. As snow in summer and as rain in harvest, so honor is not seemly for a fool. as the bird by wandering, as the swallow by flying, so the curse causeless shall not come. A whip for the horse, a bridle for the ass, and a rod. Lest thou also be like unto him. Answer a fool according to his folly. Lest he be wise in his own conceit. He that sendeth a message by the hand of a fool cutteth off the feet and drinketh damage. The legs of the lame are not equal. So is a parable in the mouth of fools. As he that bindeth a stone in a sling, so is he that giveth honor to a fool, as a thorn goeth up into the hand of a drunkard, so is the parable in the mouth of fools. The great God that formed all things both rewardeth the fool and rewardeth transgressors. As a dog returneth to his vomit, so a fool returneth to his folly. Seest thou a man wise in his own conceit? There is more hope of a fool than of him. The slothful man saith, there is a lion in the way, a lion is in the streets. As the door turneth upon his hinges, so doth the slothful upon his bed. The slothful hideth his hand in his bosom. It grieveth him to bring it again to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own conceit than seven men that can render a reason. He that passeth by and meddleth with strife, belonging not to him, is like one that taketh a dog by the ears. As a madman who casteth firebrands, arrows, and death, so is the man that deceiveth his neighbor and saith, am not I in sport? Where no wood is, there the fire goeth out. So where there is no tale-bearer, the strife ceaseth. As coals are to burning coals and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. The words of a tale-bearer are as wounds, and they go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Burning lips and a wicked heart are like a potsherd covered with silver dross. He that hateth dissembleth with his lips and layeth up deceit within him. When he speaketh fair, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Whose hatred is covered by deceit, his wickedness shall be showed before the whole congregation. Whoso diggeth a pit shall fall therein, and he that rolleth a stone, it will return upon him. A lying tongue hateth those that are afflicted by it, and a flattering mouth worketh ruin. Proverbs 26. Army Special Forces medic will receive the Medal of Honor for Afghanistan heroism. Sure, a senior medical sergeant with Special Forces Operational Detachment Alpha 3336 within Special Operations Task Force 33 had been deployed to Afghanistan's Shock Valley in Nuristan province. According to an Army release, his task as a medic was to support operators who were hunting high-value targets of the Hebza Islam Gulbuddin, a militia group with ties to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. The militants had a foothold in the Shock Valley. As the team navigated through the valley, 6 April 2008, a firefight quickly erupted and a series of insurgent sniper fire, rocket-propelled grenades, and small arms and machine gun fire forced the unit into a defensive fighting position, Army officials said in a release. Sure had heard that a forward element was also trapped by enemy fire with multiple soldiers reported wounded. With disregard for his own safety, Sergeant Sure took off through a hail of bullets and then began scaling the rock face to get to the casualties. His dramatic Silver Star citation states, during initial movement to the base of the mountain, he treated a teammate wounded by shrapnel in his neck from an RPG blast that blew him off his feet. After that soldier had been treated, Schur continued to fight his way down to the pinned down forward troops, killing multiple insurgents in combat that lasted for more than an hour. Eventually, he got to the location where wounded soldiers were trapped under enemy fire. Under intense insurgent fire, Sergeant Schur reached the pinned down elements of the ODA and immediately rendered aid to 4 critically wounded U.S. and 10 injured commandos, the citation reads. He treated multiple life-threatening gunshot wounds until additional teammates arrived. Schur himself was not unscathed in the conflict. He was hit by a sniper fire in the helmet and arm while dashing a fraught 15 meters through enemy fire to reach his team sergeant, who was badly wounded. He repeated the deadly journeys through the firestorm to reach other teammates whose legs had been severed by heavy enemy fire, a time bullets impacted just feet from where Schur rendered aid, according to the citation. Sergeant Schur rendered life-saving aid to 4 critically wounded casualties for more than 5.5 hours, the citation reads. As the lone medic at the besieged location and almost overrun and fighting against nearly 200 insurgent fighters, Sergeant Schur's bravery and poise under fire saved the lives of all wounded casualties under his care. Before the day was over, Schur had evacuated 3 critically wounded soldiers down a near vertical 60-foot cliff using a rig of nylon webbing he designed himself and shielding the wounded from falling rocks with his own body. The White House announcement Friday night was unequivocal. Schur's actions had saved the lives of his teammates. Schur, who enlisted in the Army in September 2002, was honorably discharged as a staff sergeant in May 2009. He is now a special agent in the Secret Service, where he currently serves in the Special Operations Division within the Secret Service's counter-assault team, according to the White House announcement. He lives in Burke, Virginia, near Washington, D.C., with his wife, Miranda, and 2 sons, 10 and 7. Schur will be the 11th soldier to receive the Medal of Honor for heroism in Afghanistan. Oh, well. Let's see, where are we at today? Nothing up my sleeve. Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat. You know, I heard some of that stuff on the radio here, but I was looking for the information, and one of the listeners had sent that to me, and I thank them for that. Commendable, highly commendable. Firefight that lasted 5.5 hours, evacuating people down a near vertical cliff. Recently, pretty much from the get-go of our broadcast back in January, we've been covering insurgency, and sometimes it seems that the news media, that most likely couldn't spell insurgency if their life depended on it, but after the insurgency broke out in Afghanistan and Iraq in the earlier 2000s, then there was a big scramble to try to give a definition or an outline. And they've done a pretty good job about convincing the American people that the insurgents, some dude with a turban and a beard and an AK yelling Allah Akbar, and that couldn't be further from the truth. We've covered numerous insurgent movements all around the world, from General Grievous in Cyprus to Fidel Castro in Cuba to the Viet Cong and the Viet Minh and Mao Zedong and a whole bunch of them in between over in Algeria, in the French, other places. The American resistance to the British 240 years ago that led up to the American Revolution was a classic example of insurgent movement. Three main parts generally, and it depends. There's different people have different formulas and percentages and phases and things like that, but generally, not to be confused with the car on the Dukes of Hazzard, that the insurgency has three main components. They have the political subversives, the guerrillas, and the terrorists. Now, obviously, there's the underground and the auxiliary that provide certain parts, but the main parts. Now, the political subversives get together and decide that there's a problem with the government, and they start getting organized in the phase one in the incipient movement. They might petition the government. They may write a declaration of independence and air their grievances. And as usual, the government ignores them. We just ignore them. They'll go away. But as the insurgents start to gain recruits, and they'll get a cause, reason why we're upset. And then the government comes to a decision on, well, are we going to spend the money to outfit the military with more tanks and helicopters and guns and bombs and just crush the insurgents? Or sometimes the insurgents have a legitimate grievance. Maybe they live out in the hinterland and all they want is the government to come in and dig a water well and fix some of these roads so the people can get their crops to the marketplace. But oftentimes we've seen through history that the government likes to keep the people oppressed. And so the government usually spends its money on guns and bombs and tanks. And you know, we've covered quite a bit of the different aspects in the writings like of Che Guevara and statements by Fidel and Sun Tzu, Kalamazoo, and everything. And a lot of this is nothing new, but oftentimes when people decide to develop an insurgency, the one thing that they overlook is, what are they going to do after the insurgency succeeds? And oftentimes when that occurs, then you have other insurgent groups that come in while the insurgents have expended all their effort and energy and things like that to get the government to either fail or to at least wave the white flag, because sometimes the government says, well, we're really losing, but we don't want to lose at all, so we'll just surrender half, kind of like what's going on with the FARC in Colombia. Just sign a peace treaty, and as long as you guys stay over there, we'll stay over here, and we'll all just kind of get along. And that works for a while, until either the government decides that they're not going to put up with the insurgents anymore, or the insurgents don't stay on their side and start more problems, and then it's all back on again. Because all warfare is based on deception. So therefore, when capable, feign incapacity, when active, inactivity, when near, make it appear that you're far away, or when far away, that you're near. Offer the enemy a bait to lure him, feign disorder, and strike. When he concentrates, prepare against him. Where he is strong, avoid him. Anger is general and confuse him. Pretend inferiority and encourage his ignorance. Keep him under a strain and wear him down. When he is united, divide him. Attack where he's unprepared. Sally out when he does not expect you. And these are the strategies key to victory. And that quotation above is taken from Sun Tzu's essay on the art of war. Now, Sun Tzu is quoted to make a point. It is that modern warfare is, in its most common usage, a cant phrase, indicative of the confusion of journalists and politicians who mistake technology for science. For despite the impressive technological innovations of the 20th century, the principles of warfare are not modern but ancient, and they are well established when Caesar marched out on his first campaign. And what is true of war in general is even more true, if possible, of guerrilla warfare in particular. Now, obviously, guerrilla actions are going to have a certain military objective to obtain weapons, ammunition, and supplies, to inflict casualties, to force the enemy to overextend his lines so that his communications may be disrupted and small units picked off one at a time by locally superior rebel forces. Now, obviously, none of this can occur except in the presence of certain distinct social and political conditions, which combine to produce a potentially revolutionary situation. And successful insurgency presupposes the existence of a valid popular grievance, sharp social divisions, an unsound or stagnant economy, an oppressive government. And these factors obtaining, revolution will still be far off unless there exists or comes into existence the nucleus of a revolutionary organization capable of articulating and exploiting popular dissatisfaction with the status quo. And then, you know, they release their Declaration of Independence. Now, the means is not important. The important element is the leadership itself. Because when conflict occurs, whether spontaneous or induced, the revolutionary leaders must be capable of explaining and rationalizing its confused and often apparently accidental character. Now, isolated acts of defiance must be given coherency within the revolutionary frame of reference. The leadership must be prepared to make the most of every opportunity to accelerate the process of social ferment and political disruption. So the first task of the revolutionary cadre must be to relate each incident and each phase of the conflict to a great cause, so that revolutionary violence is seen as the natural and moral means to be to a desired end, and the masses of the people are increasingly involved. Now, the precise cause itself is not of great consequence. One is often as good as another. In Cuba, for example, the corruption of Batista regime and its illegitimacy were seemingly sufficient causes for the well-to-do middle class, so long as its members individually did not take any great personal risk. Economic nationalism was the real cause of the rich and the ambitious industrialists and entrepreneurs who opposed Batista. Now, the overthrow of Batista was presented as a panacea, the remedy of all existing evils, as a cause that related and made understandable each isolated political development, the assassination of a policeman, the martyrdom of a terrorist, the suspension of civil liberties or of a public demonstration demanding their restoration. Because any disruption of the ordinary routine, anything that helped to undermine the regime, was held up as a skirmish or a battle in a great crusade. Now, the state of mind prevailing and the process of cutting away Batista's support and increasing the pressure against him both inside and outside of the country continued according to a pattern that we've examined in detail earlier. Now, the Cuban example provides, as well as any other, the recipe for a successful insurgency. Now, the prerequisites are, one, an unstable political situation marked by sharp social divisions and usually, but not always, by a foundering and stagnant economy. Two, a political objective based on firm moral and ideological grounds that can be understood and accepted by the majority as the overriding cause of the insurgency, desirable in itself and worthy of any sacrifice. Number three, an oppressive government with which no political compromise is possible. And finally, number four, some form of revolutionary political organization capable of providing dedicated and consistent leadership towards the accepted goal. Now, there's one final requirement, the clear possibility or even a possibility of success. And until people believe that a government can be overthrown, and it must be the first act of the insurgency to demonstrate this possibility by successful defiance of military force, the attempt will not be made. The revolutionary following will not be found. Now, the specific techniques or tactics of guerrilla warfare are not, except in unimportant detail, to be learned from text, because they relate always to the specific local situation and are supremely expedient. The guerrilla is, above all, an improviser. The nature of his improvisation depends, naturally, on immediate and long-range objectives, the terrain, the relative strength of his forces and those of the enemy, and the material means at his disposal, and similar factors. Now, when a choice of ground is possible, the terrain for guerrilla operations should be carefully selected. The ideal will be found in a country that is more rural than urban, mountainous rather than flat, and thickly forested rather than bare, with extensive railway lines, bad roads, and an economy that is preponderantly agricultural rather than industrial. The terrain should afford both natural concealment and obstacles to hinder the movement of the military transport, mountains and swamps where tanks and trucks cannot go, woods and thick brush that provide cover from aerial observation and attack, forest from which to strike quickly, and safety at the enemy rail and highway communications in which to ambush small military units. Now, the large rural towns can be garrisoned, and tiny hamlets cannot. Or where there are many of them, only a few soldiers can be assigned to each, and to create such rural outposts is worse than useless, since each individual post can easily be overwhelmed, its soldiers captured or killed, their arms and ammunition seized, and another propaganda victory thus scored by the insurgents. Now, the danger of being isolated far from the populated areas has been demonstrated by the experience of guerrillas in Malaya and the Philippines, because in both instances, the military succeeded in isolating the insurgents, cutting them off from the source of their strength, with results fatal to the insurgencies. Now, even in well-policed large cities, a sympathetic population can protect active insurgents, and the draconian methods used by the French in Algeria virtually stamped out the FLN underground there, but only because of the Muslims of the Kashmir were already separated racially and physically from the French population. soldiers, especially foreigners, to suppress urban rebellion, as in Budapest, by treating the entire metropolis as a city under wartime siege. Now, in suburban areas, on the other hand, a concealment was the determining factor, and the guerrillas who worked closer to the larger towns, interdicting the highways and cutting communications and power lines, operated in squads of 3 to 8 men, striking from ambush and then quickly hiding in the brush, or at times in the homes of the residents. Now, respect to the conditions that prevailed in most Latin American republics, Che Guevara considers that a nucleus of 30 to 50 armed men is sufficient to initiate a guerrilla insurgency with good assurance of success. Now, the guerrilla nucleus initiates the conflict, if possible, on the edge of the wilderness sanctuary in a thinly populated agricultural area with a marginal economy within easy striking distance of the strategic targets, railway lines that can be cut, communications that can be disrupted, mining of the industrial plants that can be sabotaged, small military or police posts from which arms can be seized. Now, at the same time, the urban insurrection of the hit-and-run rather than sustained character is created by the revolutionary underground so as to give the insurgency a general national complexion for maximum propaganda effect. Now, when the first excitement has died away and order has been restored in the towns where the uprisings have occurred, the guerrillas can expect the army to bring the battle to them. They will not have to seek it. The government will order a bandit suppression campaign. Troops will be dispatched by motor convoy or airlift to the region of reported guerrilla activity. Spotter planes will skim the treetops seeking the insurgents. Soldiers will occupy the villages and patrol the roads. Foot columns will penetrate deeply into rebel territory, trying to make contact. And helicopters may be used to ferry troops to strategic encampments deep in the forest or mountains from which patrols can fan out in search of the rebels. Now, if the military commander knows what he's about, he may adopt some variation of the French oil slick technique, grinding the region on his map and attempting to clear it square at a time, driving the guerrillas slowly towards a prepared killing zone, where their only apparent route of escape will bring them into the open, much as tigers are driven by beaters into the guns of the hunters. Now, the oil slick method is theoretically sound, but in practice, it is far from foolproof. Since it is a rare government can admit serious concern over the activities of small bands of guerrillas. The chances are that the military force sent on the suppression campaign will be far from adequate for a task in which a ratio of 10 to 1 is prescribed and 500 soldiers to each guerrilla would not be at all excessive. Now, the guerrillas will not give battle until the terrain favors them. Their effort will be to lure the enemy into the situations in which numbers are of little account because the way is too steep and the passage too narrow for more than a few to proceed at a time. When fighting begins, it will be on the ground of the rebels' own choosing, preferably from commanding heights, with dense cover and limited visibility where a few determined men can hold up an army. Now, ambushes will be prepared in such a manner that a small portion of the advancing military column, its vanguard, will be separated from the rest when the firing commences. The fire of the main body of the guerrillas will be concentrated on the vanguard. The objective of the ambush must be the complete destruction of the advanced group and seize its arms and ammunition, the latter task being accomplished while a small guerrilla rear guard delays the rest of the army column. Now, in this connection. Che Guevara writes, when the force of the guerrilla band is small and it is desired above all to detain and slow down the advance of an invading column, groups of snipers from 2 to 10 in number should be distributed all around the column at each of the 4 cardinal points. In this situation, combat can be begun, for example, on the right flank. When the enemy centers his action on that flank and fires on it, shooting will begin at that moment from the left flank. At another moment, from the rear guard or from the vanguard, and so forth. So with a very small expenditure of ammunition, it's possible to hold the enemy in check. Now, the superior mobility and size of the guerrilla force are its main assets. The danger that they themselves may be encircled is usually more apparent than real. Night, as Guevara has noted, is the best ally of the guerrilla fighter. Although the Cubans use the phrase encirclement phase to describe the look of someone who was frightened, Castro's guerrillas never suffered a single casualty through encirclement, and Guevara considers it no real problem for a guerrilla force. His prescription, take adequate measures to impede the advance of the enemy until nightfall and then exfiltrate. A relatively simple matter for a small group of men in country well known to them where the cover is good. Now, in the first months of the insurgency, when the army is on the offensive, the tactics of the ambush and evasion are standard and sufficient. The activities of the army itself are enough to advise the rebel cause. Mounting military casualties cannot be kept secret. The high cost of the anti-guerrilla campaign will be an embarrassment to the government, which will be hard put to explain what it is doing or failing to do. And each encounter will strengthen the guerrillas while weakening the morale of their military opponents. The guerrilla soldier ought always to have in mind, as Guevara writes, is his source of supply of arms is the enemy, and that, except in special circumstances, he ought not to engage in a battle that will not lead to his capture of such equipment. The enemy vanguard is made a special target of guerrilla fire for a sound psychological reason, to induce fear, or at any rate, to excessive caution that will paralyze the will and retard the free movement of the enemy. When the soldier in the first rank invariably are killed, few will wish to be in the vanguard, and without a vanguard, there is no movement. And such reasoning may not always apply to professional troops. Professional officers are trained to accept casualties as the price of battle. And nevertheless, it has been a constant complaint of American military advisors in South Vietnam that the Vietnamese field commanders commonly refuse to advance against strong guerrilla positions without artillery support and preparatory airstrikes that give the Viet Cong guerrillas time to retire from the field. Now, the insurgency continuing, the military may be expected sooner or later to give up the futile pursuit of the guerrilla force and leave it to its wilderness sanctuary, if for no other reason than the political. Because, as we've mentioned before, few governments can long sustain the political embarrassment of an expensive and well-publicized campaign in which there is no progress to report. Within a matter of weeks or months, the government will be forced to announce a victory, having failed to produce one. The public outside of the war zone will be informed that the insurrection has been suppressed. The bodies of a few civilian casualties may even be displayed by way of evidence, and the troops will be withdrawn to posts and garrisons in more settled territory, falling back on the strategy of containment of the insurrection. Now, if the insurgency is to exceed, the guerrillas must, of course, refuse to be contained. They will now assume the offensive, taking advantage of their new freedom to organize night raids on the small military outposts that ring their free zones, and using the attacks on such outposts as bait to lure military reinforcements into ambush on the roads. Now, a successful action provides more arms, new guerrilla units will be organized, and new zones of operation opened. Guerrillas filtering through the military lines attack isolated military police units in the villages or on the periphery of the free zones, forcing the army to pull back to reinforce those points. With still more room in which to maneuver, the rebels occupy the outlying farms, move into the small hamlets that cannot be defended economically, and efforts will now be made to discourage, although not absolutely to prevent, the military convoys from entering certain zones. Now, the roads will be mined, tank traps dug, defenses in depth constructed so that the troops will have to fight their way into the rebel territory through a series of ambuscades, the guerrillas at each stage offering light resistance and then falling back on the next position. Now, as the rebels' strength grows, the army is confronted with a difficult dilemma. Having superior numbers and heavier weapons, it will still be able to enter the rebel zones in strength, but only at the cost of some casualties and with no advantage, since the ground gained will have no strategic or economic value commensurate with the cost of occupying it. Now, if the troops should remain in force, the guerrillas should simply transfer their operations to another zone. Now, the army cannot be everywhere, yet if the troops do not remain, the territory is, in effect, ceded to the insurgents, who proceed to turn its agricultural economy and its rural population to their own purpose. This is the dilemma of the military commander. Now, it is, of course, sharpened by political problems. Large chunks of the agricultural economy cannot be surrendered to the insurgents without political consequences. And those whose fortunes are affected, the traders, the absentee landowners, and the like, will be certain to put pressure on the government to do something. They may seek a political alternatives. The general public will be excited and divided by the deterioration of the government's position, and as it becomes more apparent, now the more radical elements of the urban society will be emboldened. The revolutionary sentiment stirred up by the underground will grow stronger and more widespread, and the government will grow progressively more fearful and repressive, and then the agitprop comes on, because that's what the insurgents want to do. They want to provoke things so the government overreacts, and then when the government overreacts, they propagandize that into demonstrating that the government is oppressive. Now, in those type of circumstances, and considering that no army can occupy all of the national territory, the logic and natural course of the regime will be the gradually withdrawal of troops from the countryside to the larger centers of population, and the rural areas thus will be slowly and reluctantly surrendered to the insurgents. And with expanded resources and manpower and material, the insurgency will continue to grow. And as it gains strength, the guerrilla bands will become guerrilla armies. The larger villages will be captured. The railway bridges will be blown and the highways cut. One by one, the towns and then the cities will be isolated, their vital supplies restricted, civilian transport reduced to a trickle, and the military convoys may still come and go, but not without peril and not with any important effect in a country most of which will already be in the hands of the revolution. Now, the pattern that we've described is observable. It's already happened in the Western Hemisphere, and it's happening right now. Certainly, it's not the only pattern that the revolutionary warfare can follow. Now, is the United States itself immune? The complexity of modern, urban, heavily industrialized societies make them extremely vulnerable to wide-scale sabotage, a fact that has not gone unremarked by the extremists of the small but fanatical black nationalist movement in the United States. The extent of their commitment may be judged by the February 1965 disclosure of a bizarre plot said to have been hatched by members of the Black Nationalist Revolutionary Action Movement, blow up the Statue of Liberty in New York, the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia, and the Washington Monument. In an article in Esquire published 4 months earlier, in October of 64, entitled "The Red Chinese American Negro," the Negro journalist William Worthy reported, with an eye on expected financial and material support from Asia and Africa, RAM has proclaimed the necessity to utilize the three basic principal powers held by Negroes. One, the power to stop the machinery of government. Two, the power to hurt the economy. And three, the power of unleashing violence. Now, the details were clearly spelled out elsewhere by a Negro leader who has since been linked to RAM. Writing in a monthly newsletter, the Crusader, Robert William, a former chapter president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, who fled to Cuba after a racial incident in Moreau, North Carolina in 1961, pictured the coming black revolution in the United States in the following terms. When massive violence comes, the USA will become a bedlam of confusion and chaos. The factory, telephone, and radio workers will be afraid to report to their jobs. All transportation will grind to a complete standstill. Essential pipelines will be severed and blown up, and all manner of sabotage will occur. Clash will occur inside the army forces. At U.S. military bases around the world, local revolutionaries will side with Afro-GIs. The new concept of revolution defines military science and tactics. The new concept is lightning campaigns conducted in highly sensitive urban communities, with the paralysis reaching the small communities and spreading to the farm areas. The old method of guerrilla warfare, as carried out from the hills and countryside, would be ineffective in a powerful country like the USA. Any such source could be wiped out in an hour. Well, I see we're kind of coming up in on the end of today's broadcast. And now you kind of got, we did a tad bit of review at the beginning, but it was a lightning round. And then we kept going with our lesson of insurgency from the outside to the inside, from the inside to the outside. Problem is, with the government, if you try to guard everywhere, you guard nowhere. And the guerrilla, the insurgent, has the upper hand because the guerrilla gets to choose the time and the place to attack. And because the government never knows where the guerrilla is going to strike, then the government has to guard everywhere. And so it's just this constant circle. Borderlandbeat.com, 1 October 2018, Los Zetas becoming corporate narcos. one of the most bloodthirsty cartels in the country, Los Zetas, has achieved a dominant position not only because of its brutal power, but also because of the business practices that bring it closer to the behavior of a company. That is the impressive conclusion reached by the specialist Guadalupe Carrera Cabrera. In a widely documented story that became the book Los Zeta Inc., published by Planets in its Temel's collection of today, the academic and researcher Guadalupe Carrera Cabrera reveals how Los Zeta Cartel, initially formed by ex-soldiers who served as assassins, organized each of the commercial practices in a corporate manner. They included contraband, kidnapping, and piracy of music and movies. A special mention is the incursion of Los Zetas into the illegal trade of crude oil, natural gas, and gasoline, not only by means of robbery or looting, but also with the use of facade companies that take advantage of the constitutional changes made in the sexennium of the President Enrique Peña Nieto to the legislation of the Mexican energy sector. In addition, the author, who is associate professor of the Schar School of Politics and Government at George Mason University in Virginia, United States, affirms that the government's strategy of confronting drug traffickers by means of weapons contributed to the situation in the country that now resembles that of a civil war that yields economic benefits for some. There you go. That's been my contention for quite a long time, and a lot of people are coming to that conclusion also, that the cartels, not only in Mexico, but going back to at least Pablo Escobar in Colombia, the Medellin and the Cali cartels, were actually insurgent groups. A clear example of that is what happened with the FARC in Colombia. And we also see the same phenomenon going on with the cartels in Mexico, where they forced the government out of an area. They kill the mayor, they kill the school teachers, they kill the police, they drive away everybody, and then come the de facto government. They have a taxation system. They have a security system. They have a crude judicial system. They set up their own laws and their own rules and have the enforcers. They create a what would look like on the outside a facade, true government, but they're not recognized by other countries, but they still have all the trappings of government, and they set up their own schools, their own security, and they set up and start to cultivate and grow their products like marijuana, opium. And once again, I heard the other day of about some people going on and on about Afghanistan and our soldiers over there, and that's what's fueling the opioid epidemic here in the United States. And you try to get through to some of these people, and they still don't listen because they're running on information that's 15 years old, that there's more than 70,000 acres in Sinaloa, Mexico, under cultivation of opium. And there's a gazillion acres south of El Paso, Texas, in the Sierra Madres that's also under cultivation. So it boils down to logistics. So why would the cartels have to get into some pipeline that brings opium all the way from Afghanistan, all the way across Africa, all the way across the Atlantic Ocean into South America or Central America, and then bring it up through Mexico when they can grow it, harvest it, refine it, and they can bring it directly across the border? And you know, the I'll admit there is periodically a kilo here or a kilo there of Afghan opium that makes it here, but it's mostly been smuggled out in very small quantities to Nigeria, where the corrupt Nigerian airline crews will put a kilo here or a kilo there, and it makes it here. But sciences and chemistry is to the state where if you catch somebody with opium, and you don't have to question them to ask them where it came from, they can chemically analyze a sample of heroin, and they can tell you if it was grown in Laos, Burma, Afghanistan, Colombia, Mexico. So, I don't know. It just seems to be we got this. Some people, just like I heard the other day, somebody called in, it's odd that we're talking about the Los Zetas, and they want to sit here and go, oh, but you know, the Los Zetas, they were brought up here and trained by gentlemen. Lonely passes through. Yeah, they were trained by the U.S. Special Forces. But what they don't tell you, that was 20 years ago, and all the people that were trained are either dead or in prison. The little parts of the story that, once again, people are running on information that's 15 or 20 years old. Well, it sounds like we got the music coming up here. We kind of blew through that hour. I'll be over on the Micro Effect on Thursday, starting at the same time, but we got 2 hours each on there. So thanks for being with me. We send this one out to Lily Grace Antoinette, and stay tuned to to Liberty Tree Radio for the rest of the broadcast today. Thanks. Later.
Bye.
Some people are crazy in time.